What you heard was an IRIB English radio program.
My name is Clayton Thomas Mueller. I'm a Cree man from Pugadawagan First Nation, which is part of the Cree Nation in northern Manitoba. I think all Native people are born activists when they're born here in Canada or in the United States or any colonial country where Indigenous peoples live under occupation. You know, you're born into activism, and whether or not you take action, you know, kind of is the choice of your life path, I guess. I think about the future a lot and about, you know, how when I was a child, I had access to so much abundance and beauty, you know, in terms of participating in our culture and participating in harvesting and hunting, you know, from the fruits of our sacred Mother Earth. And I want my sons to be able to have that. And the way things are looking right now with mega development and with climate change and with capitalism, their chances are becoming slimmer and slimmer to have the same relationship that I did with the sacred circle of life. And so for me, being an Indigenous activist here in Canada, it's something that I have no choice but to do. And so I've dedicated my life to it.
No more pipeline!
No more pipeline!
No more pipeline!
No more pipeline!
No more tankers! No more tankers!
We can't drink oil! We can't drink oil!
The Inka Dene Alliance, with the inspiration of the 1980s Constitutional Train Action, which was an action at the time where First Nations rented a train and drove it across the country and stopped in each community to educate people about Aboriginal rights. You know, the Inka Dene Alliance took the inspiration from that lesson, and they rented a train and they called it the Freedom Train. And they rode that train from Smithers, British Columbia, all the way to Toronto to stand up against the mega corporation Enbridge, which is a oil transport company. They build pipelines. Enbridge is proposing to build a, you know, 900,000 barrel per day pipeline right through the heart of British Columbia's Great Bear Rainforest. This pipeline, if it was built, would cross over 1,200 salmon-producing rivers and streams, all critical spiritual, cultural, and food sources to local Indigenous peoples, you know, dozens and dozens of tribes that have been there forever. Threatened by, you know, a potential oil rupture by one of these pipelines into one of those salmon rivers. So many people have rose up in a movement against Enbridge, against the Harper Conservative government, against, you know, the provincial government of Alberta and British Columbia to educate Canadians about the insanity of this pipeline and the insanity of our government for wanting to build it. When they arrived in Toronto, thousands of people met to greet them and joined them in their march through the streets of Toronto's financial district, all the way to the steps of the hotel where Enbridge was having their annual shareholder meeting. And we sent a very powerful message to Enbridge that this pipeline will not be built, and that the corporate board and the CEO are taking unfathomable risks with shareholders' money by investing in a project that'll face decades of legal opposition.
My name It's Terry Teege. I'm the Vice Chief of Carrier Sicani Tribal Council, North Central British Columbia. We call ourselves the Yinka Dene, which is, means in our language, people of the earth. And basically, we looked at this Enbridge Northern Gateway project. When we looked at all the benefits and the risks, we didn't want this project. So what this demonstration is about is telling the investors into Enbridge Northern Gateway Pipeline and those investors and inform them that we don't support the project.
When we look at the land, we see it as a living force, a living, sustainable way things are in the woods. That you have your trees, you have your rock nation, you have your wind, you have your fire, you have all of that foliage that's there, all that beauty that's there. And they don't see how we see things. If you take something, out, you're taking the essence of that out of there. You're not putting that essence back. You're not leaving that essence there. You're not covering it back in its natural form. You're just extracting for wealth. You're forgetting that everything that's there in the woods needs that. We all need that. They don't seem to care about the water. They're very tunnel vision. They're like this. That's how I see it.
They keep continuing trying to get this project approved, even though they don't have our permission to be in our territory. And we've tried everything we could to work with them, to talk to them and explain our position. And they've to this date, have not been honest. They've not returned the honor, that we have them of actually, we are hosting or looking at their proposal, and then they've not answered any of the questions we've asked. And based on the information we received and on our law that we've governed with for thousands of years, we've made a decision not to allow Enbridge within our territory at all.
The spirit of the industry has no spirit, because everything has a spirit. Everything has an agency. Even an agency, we believe that it has a spirit that governs it, because it's the people of it that look after that. And they don't have, the industry doesn't have that, because if you look at it, if you look at what it does, like what's its mechanism, it's to assimilate, it's to control, it's to take it away. It's the mindset of just taking. It's a mindset of taking. It doesn't seem to have that concept of tomorrow, my children are going to need this.
We've always made decisions on our land that we base them on our grandkids and great-grandkids down the road. We base all of our decisions on the land to make sure that anything that comes in is we can deal with, and the land can deal with it. Looking at this project, it goes against our traditional governance by not respecting the fact that we said no. It has a potential to devastate all of our ways of life and gathering food that we have. The very thing that gives us life, water, is most precious, and it's going to cross. It would cross into three major water sheds, two in British Columbia, and then of course the Athabasca or the Arctic thing through Alberta and through the Rockies.
And coastal First Nations have, shared a sacred relationship with that ocean, and Canadians in general share a sacred relationship with our Pacific Northern coastline.
I'm Dave. I'm here because I'm a concerned citizen about the environment, and basically the recent environmental regulations, how they've been essentially streamlined to benefit corporations. It's kind of important to get our voices heard and let them know that we're not, them being Enbridge and other oil companies, that we're not particularly fans of that.
And our story isn't unique. There are many stories out there in Central America, South America, where a lot of the indigenous people are being subverted, not only by multinational companies, but by their own government. Really, there's a lot of human rights violations that are occurring, much worse than Canada. This is a human rights violation in our definition.
After banking and the financial sector, mining is Canada's largest export in terms of its international presence of Canadian multinational corporations, and Canadian mining projects are systematically engaged in ecological disasters wherever they go, whether it's Central America, South America, the Caribbean, Africa, or the Asia Pacific. Canadian mining companies leave a trail of ecological destruction.
They are using the name of Canada. This is a really well-known country as a democratic country, peaceful country, peacemaker country. And when people know about Canada and they hear about Canadians, they open arms in the beginning. But when they know there is coming a mining open pit or is coming a huge extractive industry that's doing a huge damage to the environment, people start getting like totally opposite thinking about Canadians, right? Because Canadian companies are using this name a lot.
And whether it's displacing indigenous peoples or poor peasants from their land and then poisoning their water systems, mining is a very environmentally destructive process, particularly when it's not being properly regulated, which it's not, either by the Canadian government or by most third world governments.
They use the technology that we know as open pit. It's not just destroy the environment, right? To get the minerals from the earth, what they have to do is destroy the surface. To access to under surface, they have to destroy everything that is in the surface. And in the surface is the people, the village, the town, the river, the trees, the forest, everything that is in the surface, it has to be destroyed.
And so as a result, you have commonly, you see, mining companies dump their waste, which includes high levels of arsenic or cyanide and so on and other chemicals, into local water systems, or they create what they call a tailings pond for their waste, which is supposed to be properly lined, but they don't do it properly, and then the water, the toxic water leaks into the soil, into the waterbed in a local community, and it destroys plant life, it poisons people, and it's well documented from Guatemala to Honduras to the Dominican Republic to Tanzania and beyond. It's well documented the toxic impact of Canadian mining companies, and the Canadian government does nothing. It does zero about this.
I think that we have to be very mindful of the fact that Canada continues to generate all its wealth, all its, assets, everything, on the backs of indigenous peoples, and that the entire economic paradigm of this country is based on keeping indigenous peoples subjugated and keeping us from having self-determination and control over our land and resources.
Canada doesn't live up to their human rights. What is they're obligated to do by the under what is known as the United Nations, under the United Nations Indigenous Peoples Conference. Well, really, there's a covenant within the United Nations where it says free, prior, and informed consent, yet Canada does not live up to it. And that's, really what they're doing is subverting a lot of international laws as well as their own proclamations where they stated that they have a fiduciary duty to protect indigenous people.
Canada, like America, like Europe, like Australia, like Israel, is a huge advocate of human rights when it advances their neoliberal free market agenda. Last year Canada went through their periodical UN Human Rights Review, and they scored 8th on the planet in the UN Human Rights Index. But when the committee analyzed Canada's human rights record through its Aboriginal policy and its treatment of Indigenous peoples, Canada scored 48th.
Obviously, Canada has a very deep-rooted relationship to colonialism within Canadian borders. The whole existence of Canada is premised on the dispossession of First Nations peoples and the colonial administration of their communities by the Canadian government via Indian Affairs. But also, even outside Canadian borders, there's a long history of Canadian colonial or imperial practices. For example, the banking industry has a long history in the Caribbean and Latin America. There are mining companies that have relationships to various Central American dictatorships or the dictatorship in Indonesia in the Cold War period. And so there's a long history of colonialism, both within and beyond Canada.
It's more than colonialism. It's, you know, killing the spirit of a nationhood, the belief of a nationhood. You know, it's not colonialism anymore. It's too radical. It's too racial, the approach that this federal government is taking, ignoring the First Nation people, you know, who use and occupy the land.
You know, a lot of people don't get educated in school about how Indian reservations were created. A lot of people don't understand that, you know, the South African apartheid system was based on the reservation apartheid system here in Canada. You know, we didn't have these settlements prior to colonization. For example, residential schools where they took our children away from our parents for 100 years and put them into essentially work camps and beat them for speaking their language and cut their hair. You know, and these schools were magnets for, you know, predators, sexual predators of kids. You know, a lot of the nuns and priests and groundskeepers and whatnot were straight up pedophiles. A lot of our kids, including my own mom and, you know, a lot of my relatives that went, you know, faced severe abuse, sexual, physical abuse when they went to residential school. And I think that what a lot of people don't understand is that Canada is an apartheid country, you know. It still is in very many ways.
Historically, when capitalism emerges in Canada, the focus of the Canadian state vis-a-vis Indigenous peoples was to destroy their Indigenous cultures, their economies, their polities, and so on, and forcefully remove them from the land. And the goal was to gain access to the land and its subsurface minerals and resources. And I would argue that that has been definitive of Canada's relationship with Indigenous peoples ever since to the present day.
The language that is utilized by the Canadian government in dealing with First Nations and talking about their relationship with First Nations globally is the same colonial racist language used by the Zionist government of Israel when talking about Palestinians. It's grounded in the same Eurocentric kind of white patriarchal, you know, kind of power base, you know, that subjugates and looks at, you know, either Palestinian or Indigenous peoples as children. You know, that needs to be taken care of as a problem.
The value of our culture, of the land, of the rivers and the lakes, of the practices, of the traditions, is worth so much more than the blood money dollar bills that they keep waving in our faces. Our culture, our lands, our rivers and our waters is more than priceless. It is sacred, and we aren't going to sell it down the river for a couple of, for a pipeline that is guaranteed to destroy our lives.
Shallow Waters is about a future where the land is intoxicated and it's polluted and uninhabitable, and it's sad because, and it's scary because that future is possible if we keep continuing on this industrial road that we're on. It's about a future where the Harper government and industry has turned our lands in BC into a giant Walmart.
Well, we're just wrapping up here. The Yinkadeni Alliance leadership has just come out of the annual general shareholder meeting of Enbridge. They're very clear and concise that there's absolutely no way that this pipeline nor the supertanker traffic that it promises to bring to the West Coast will ever happen. And yeah, we're tired, a little bit wet, but feeling very positive.
Environmental laws we use, their laws, and they change it
while we're still fighting. Harper doesn't care. Harper doesn't care about us. He's going to take us to court. We're going to stand in court. I don't care how long we're going to be in court, we're going to be there. My heart's hurting right now. Because governments are not going to listen. Never ever going to listen. Only reason why they're doing this, they're trying to take more of our land. We are part of this country too. They can't go on and reap the land without suffering us on a reserve. Everybody thinks Indians get it good. We don't. We come back to our homelands and look at how we live. We live like third world country. Inadequate water, inadequate homes. And they say they give us everything. We have to abide by three or four laws before we can be able to stand up and do anything. But today, we're abiding by our own hereditary law, our traditional law, the Batlats, our area. That's what we're going to stand on, and that's how we're going to win. Chanachaya! Saketne!
The earth is coming to its place of fulfillment, I guess, in terms of all of the population, the damage to the water, all of that put together. I think we're coming into a time, I don't know when this is going to happen, but I think we're coming into a time where the earth has to heal itself and it has to renew itself.
Our own Cree Nation has a prophecy, the prophecy of the seventh generation, that speaks of a time when a generation of young people would come up and they would be free from the colonial mind, you know, where they would still understand, you know, the violence of colonization, but they would not be crippled by it, and they would, you know, take action. Our prophecy talks about that, and I believe that that's right now. Right where we are.
I've heard the prophecy where the people have to unite, have to become one to make that change, to change that renewal process.
And while many get depressed or overwhelmed and even apathetic about, you know, things like climate change and the austerity agenda of these neoconservative maniacs that are running our country, I see a tremendous amount of hope and light emerging in a social movement that is rising up, to combat against the drivers of climate change, to combat against this economic paradigm, and I'm filled with hope.
In the limelight.
The fact that Europe faced energy crisis even before the Russia-Ukraine conflict. This crisis actually was exacerbated after the conflict. According to what experts have said, Europe lost its resources after the 2008 recession. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites for further details. Stay tuned for more. The website of Hill wrote in this regard, the wind has died down again in Europe. Unless you're selling kites or umbrellas, you probably don't care. But if you're a public official responsible for making sure your citizens stay warm this winter, you may be panicking. In the climate-obsessed European Union and UK, where a decades-long war against fossil fuels caused a radical shift to unstable power sources, a growing dependence on wind power is again a source of anxiety. As the Wall Street Journal reported recently, wind speeds in Hamburg fell to around 5 meters a second, or about 11 miles an hour, according to the weather forecasting site Windy.com. That wind velocity is apparently the minimum speed required for electricity generation. The journal explains speeds of around 15 meters a second or 33 meters per hour are needed to produce maximum power generation. Come again, the U.S. Weather Service declares winds of 31 meters per hour to 63 meters per hour gale force. So all those wind towers being built on the continent and in the U.S. require massive wind speeds to be fully productive. Who knew? Even as European countries rush to destroy their economies by pandering to unrealistic climate goals, the U.S. ignores the devastating results. EU countries have made every wrong turn imaginable in catering to their aggressive climate lobbies, making harmful decisions of exactly the kind being foisted onto Americans via the Biden White House. The climate zealots in the Biden administration who have plugged global warming considerations into every policy plank of every federal agency seem to have learned exactly nothing from Europe's entirely self-inflicted woes. Europe decided some years ago to move away from fossil fuels, banking on renewables like wind and solar power to supply an increasing portion of their energy needs. Incredibly, today the most consumed renewable fuel on the continent is wood, which one team of climate scientists says emits more CO2 emissions than coal. Rather than produce its own natural gas or invest in nuclear facilities, Germany adopted energy wind or energy transition in 2010. That Green New Deal precursor led to excess reliance on renewable energy, causing increased burning of coal and even dirtier lignite to plug energy shortfalls. It also ultimately meant reliance on Russian gas imports via the Nord Stream pipelines. We know how that turned out. Unable to live with that success, President Macron's environment minister in 2017, in the throes of a climate fit, banned new fossil fuel exploration, demanded a halt to all gas and diesel-powered vehicle sales by 2040, and also announced he would gradually shut down France's aging nuclear plants to pivot to renewables. Consequently, investment in France's nuclear industry waned, and today the industry, which supplies 70% of the nation's electricity, is in crisis. More than half the country's reactors have been offline for repairs, and power production is the lowest since 1993. France is now importing energy. Its nuclear output has hit a 30-year low, and there may be power outages this winter as demand turns higher. The price of electricity has surged tenfold. The UK similarly fell under the spell of climate visionaries, abandoning its encouragement of North Sea oil and natural gas investment in favour of wind power. Some 23% of power production in the UK now comes from wind. Wind that, as on the continent, has slowed down, cutting electricity output. Meanwhile, North Sea oil and gas production, which has been slowly declining since late 1990s, has endured not only hostile offshore elements, but also hostile regulations and tax regimes. Most recently, the government slapped a 25% windfall profits tax on Britain's North Sea producers, similar to a proposal lofted by the Biden administration in response to rising oil prices. Natural gas accounts for over half of the UK's electricity production. This extra tax will further reduce investment in the North Sea and likely lead to lower production. Electricity prices are 78% higher than a year ago. None of this should come as a surprise for European lawmakers. In August 2021, the wind also died, causing a shortage of electricity production in Germany, England and other countries, and driving prices through the roof. The Russia-Ukraine conflict has exacerbated Europe's energy crisis, but the war on fossil fuels has arguably been more destructive. Europe faced shortages well before Russia-Ukraine conflict. Someday, when the world has made great advancements in the ability to store electricity, wind and solar power will be reliable sources of energy. This is not the case today. To pretend otherwise is to jeopardize people's health and indeed their lives. That's why the UK is rapidly setting up warm banks, places where citizens unable to pay their electricity bills can gather to survive winter's frosty temperatures. Imagine one of the wealthiest nations on Earth at risk of freezing.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Hello, I'm Mubarak Kenya, and a big welcome to this week's edition of Africa Today.
Stay tuned with Africa Today.
Africa Today.
Western media outlets are one of Africa's greatest enemies. Their coverage of Africa is consistently biased, cementing stereotypes that Africa has a leadership crisis and the continent is incapable of producing outstanding leaders. Western media outlets also meddle in Africa's internal affairs and even incite violence and civil wars. The most recent example is the conflict in Ethiopia, where Western media outlets supported the TPLF rebel movement that planned to topple a legitimately elected government. An Ethiopian protester speaks here about Western media meddling in the country.
This thing's happened the past 3 years, you know. We've been trying to solve out the things in back home, but still he's trying. Our Prime Minister, Dr. Abe, he's trying himself. But the thing is, the other opponent party, the TPLF, they don't want the leadership that he's running. And then they start to doing, they get support from U.S. actually. They get truly support from U.S. because the overseas news, the parties which is passing CNN. Through CNN, BBC, the fake news that they produce for us.
Hello, I'm Mubarak Kenya, and a warm welcome to Africa Today, a weekly program that gives you an alternative view of news and events making headlines in Africa. In today's show, we are focusing on how mainstream Western media continue to portray Africa as the dark continent in need of civilizing. The core objective of this negative portrayal is to show that the continent requires Western enlightenment through modern-day enslavement and neocolonialism. So stay with us as our experts give us their insight on the ongoing Western media onslaught on Africa. You can also be part of the conversation by sending your comments through our social media handle.
Western media meddling in Africa. Mainstream Western media outlets are at the forefront of implementing the imperialist agenda of meddling and fomenting civil wars and political turmoil in Africa. Western media organizations present a trend of political instability in most of the countries in Africa, and even openly back rebel movements that are pro-Western and seek to topple governments that have adopted independent policies.
For instance, in Ethiopia, several demonstrations have taken place in the country slamming fake news spread by mainstream Western media outlets that openly backed the rebel movement in the country.
BBC!
BBC!
Stop!
Lying!
About
Ethiopia!
Ethiopia!
CNN!
CNN!
Shame on you!
Shame on you!
Shame on you!
They can come here and they can check it everything. Then they can go back and say the facts, the real things. As international media, they don't have to release out the news that is not true. It is not totally true.
To discuss Western media meddling in Africa, we have contacted Abayomi Azikiwe, the editor of the Pan-African Newswire. He has traveled extensively in Africa conducting field research on political economy and history. Thanks, sir, for your time today. We are also joined by Lawrence Freeman, a political and economic analyst for Africa. Thanks for joining us today.
You're welcome.
So let's start off with Lawrence Freeman. Now, what is the objective of Western media outlets in portraying Africa negatively?
The first thing you have to realize is that the majority of the Western media outlets, including the very largest ones, are part of the political establishment. They're not independent journalists seeking truth. They have an agenda. They coordinate, or at least work together with those in political power, political, financial oligarchy, who have a world geopolitical doctrine towards other countries in the world. And much of the media, and I've seen this up close myself, are not reporting honestly and not searching honestly to find out what's really going on, the truth. They are part of the political or geopolitical establishment. Therefore, you have to realize the first thing is don't think they're objective media. They're not.
The Western mass media is not neutral in the news it chooses to disseminate on Africa. The ideology of neocolonialism continues to dictate what the Western media reports on Africa. Let's now bring in Mr. Azikiwe. Do you believe these mainstream Western media outlets are serving the imperialist and neocolonial agenda?
Most definitely they are. A good example would be what happened in Ethiopia over the last 2 years. Where the United States was supporting a rebel organization. They were producing news that made the Ethiopian government look very disorganized and repressive. And also, they were attempting to tell people from the United States, including diplomatic personnel, that they needed to get out of Ethiopia because the rebels were on the verge of taking over. Now, none of this was true. And they just signed an agreement recently in South Africa and Kenya, a peace accord to disarm the TPLF rebels. So the U.S. media has been totally discredited in regard to the situation in Ethiopia. And there's so many other examples in Africa and around the world.
Ethiopian Broadcasting Authority vowed to take legal actions against foreign media distributing misinformation and unbalanced reporting, thereby meddling in the nation's unity. At the height of the Tigray conflict, Ethiopia issued warning letters to four international media houses, CNN, BBC, Reuters, and Associated Press.
And what we're reading in the Western media is not true. Reading the New York Times, reading the Washington Post, CNN, BBC, Bloomberg, all of them are pushing lies and falsehoods. And I've seen so many reporters report from Nairobi, from Kenya, and they're not here in Addis. If you look around in Addis, it is not true, and it's not the same of what these people are writing when they're not even here in this country.
Ethiopian people and government accuse mainstream Western media outlets of meddling in the country's internal affairs and backing TPLF rebels. It appears Western journalists in Africa are carrying out a hidden agenda of inciting civil strife.
This was very obvious in the case in Ethiopia. What you had is just a little bit over 2 years ago, on November 4th, in the early hours of November 4th of 2020, the TPLF, which was an ethno-nationalist organization, and their militia attacked a federal military post in Mekelle Tigray and killed many soldiers, hundreds of soldiers, stole ammunition. And the government, under the elected leadership of Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed, basically responded. But this was used to weaken the government. And my analysis at the time, which many people agree with, very early on, by 2021, a couple months after the war, I said, look, this is an attempt at regime change. They want to remove the Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed because he's independent. He's not controlled by them. And he was working on a plan for regional development and coordination.
The government of Mali has also definitely banned French broadcasters RFI and France 24 after these French media outlets disseminated fake news on the country's army. The banning of these media outlets came after the expulsion of the French ambassador to Mali, who insulted the country's government.
There are thousands and thousands and thousands of Malians today who say no to France. So what the European Union and France needs to do is respect the Malian authorities. They need to understand that the authorities in charge today are the only ones who can speak for our country.
More African countries are taking similar decisions of expelling Western journalists and diplomats who spread lies and work at the behest of spy agencies of their home countries. What's your take on this?
Yeah, some other countries have taken measures to restrict access by certain media outlets. Zimbabwe is a good example. They had, at one point, restricted the British Broadcasting Corporation because all of the news that was being put out to the world about Zimbabwe was extremely negative. The same thing in Ethiopia. The corporate media has been decrying the fact that they cannot have access to certain areas of the country, that they cannot interview directly the prime minister and the president of Ethiopia. So, yes, they are quite angry because they cannot have unfettered access to areas as well as leaders within particular governments.
During a visit to France in 2020, Egyptian President Abdel Fattah al-Sisi slammed Western media for claiming that leaders of African and Arab countries are dictators.
You, the media, focus on this issue and you depict us as having no respect for people, as if we don't like our society, or as if we are violent leaders, despots. and this is unacceptable.
Uganda's President Yoweri Museveni has also lashed out at foreign media for their coverage of various events in the country.
President Museveni once branded the BBC and other Western media organizations as enemies because of their coverage of anti-government protests. What's your take on this statement by President Museveni?
Yeah, it does look very suspicious that the opposition, one of the leading opposition figures, has been supported by the Western media. And when he was detained, he was then invited to come to the United States for medical treatment. So this really makes it appear as if the United States is supporting opposition groups in Uganda. Another example of Uganda was when the foreign minister of the Russian Federation, Sergei Lavrov, visited several African countries earlier this year. Museveni objected to the fact that the United States State Department was pressuring his government to denounce Russia in regard to their special military operation in Ukraine.
Well, thanks for that, Mr. Azikiwe. Let's take a short break, and when we come back, we shall continue our discussion on how Western media outlets are meddling in Africa. Stay with us.
Western media meddling in Africa.
You're listening to Africa Today. Africa Today is an analytical weekly review of political, economic, and social events in Africa, the world's second largest continent. The series is broadcast every week on Saturdays and Sundays by IRIB English Radio.
You're watching Africa Today, and our topic this week is on how mainstream Western media outlets meddle and deliberately give misleading information on Africa. Our experts today are Lawrence Freeman and Abayomi Azikiwe. Now, apart from biased coverage and meddling, there is deliberate misleading information. For instance, during this year's August elections in Kenya, a host of Fox News, the leading conservative news outlet in the U.S., made racist comments about pregnant Kenyan women, where she claimed that pregnant women in Kenya are not allowed to leave their houses to vote. Let's take a listen.
Right, so she's talking about, like, what voting rights?
Yeah.
That we have less voting rights here. What about in Kenya, where pregnant women can't leave the house, so they absolutely have no constructive right to vote?
Now, this was absolutely incorrect, as all women in Kenya, regardless of race, religion, or social status, have equal voting rights, just like men. Now, Mr. Freeman, why would Western media outlets engage in such blatant lies?
As we've been discussing in this interview, you have to start from the standpoint that the West, not every single person, but the majority of the Western institutions are dominated by what I would call a geopolitical doctrine, which itself is completely a fraud and doesn't represent actual serious thinking. But the way the doctrine is portrayed, it's called a zero-sum game of politics. That if the United States is going to be on top, then someone else has to be on the bottom. And in Africa, they have no concern for the African people. They don't believe in development. They don't report on development, but the West does not believe in development. They don't believe in it at all. And this shows by the fact that they don't build anything in Africa. I mean, there is building going on by some extent by Russia, by India, Japan, South Korea. China, of course, is the major powerhouse. But the West doesn't build anything because they don't care. They're not interested. They're interested in control, not development.
Now, I'll put the same question to Mr. Azikiwe. Why are mainstream media outlets in the U.S., such as Fox News, deliberately issuing misleading reports on African countries?
Well, it's sensationalism. It also attempts to make it appear as if people in other parts of the world have values that are less than people in the West. And they can also create a situation where people can even feel grateful that they live in the West because of the level of democracy that exists in the Western countries. So I think it's a number of reasons why they put out fake stories about developments in Africa, which have no bearing with reality. I mean, there were several political parties that contested the elections in Kenya this year. It was a very close race. The opposition appealed to the Supreme Court. The results were upheld. So I don't see why they should be criticizing Kenya when, in fact, right here in the United States, you have an election that took place over 2 years ago that's still disputed among many elements within the electorate in the United States.
The news media played a major role in the 1994 Rwanda genocide. Some local media outlets fueled the killings, while the Western media either ignored or seriously misconstrued what was happening. Many believe Western media outlets were complicit in the Rwanda genocide that led to nearly a million dead people.
They would not cover it in detail. They would not do any real political analysis about why the killing was taking place. Also, during that period, Bill Clinton was president of the United States, and he refused repeatedly to categorize what was going on there as genocide. So all these variables played into the character of news coverage about events in Rwanda in 1994. The U.S. media failed miserably in covering the developments that were taking place in Rwanda during that year.
Zimbabwean Information, Publicity and Broadcasting Services Minister Monica Mutsvangwa recently said it was time for Zimbabwean journalists to repel the propaganda from the West that seeks to divide and cause disunity among Zimbabweans. Are African media outlets doing enough to counter meddling by Western media outlets?
Yes, some of them are. Others are still sensitive to the criticism that is leveled against them by the United States and other Western countries. Others have trade relations with these countries, so they try to maintain a cordial discourse and relationship with these countries. But Zimbabwe is a good example where there's been many distortions about the actual situation inside the country.
Amid attempts by Western countries to counter China and Russia in Africa, a new report shows the United States is engaged in efforts to infiltrate and influence certain sectors of the South African media. According to the authors of the study, the so-called National Endowment for Democracy, a U.S.-funded agency, continues to infiltrate the South African media ecosystem.
What we found was that so-called independent media publications were not really as independent all the time as what they make themselves out to be. So we're not about being anti-American agenda or pro-Chinese or pro-Russian. We are pro-African. We are pro-defending our sovereignty from bad actors. And in this climate, the U.S. State Department, the NED, these are bad actors.
Now, a last question to Mr. Freeman. What should African countries do to tell their own stories and ensure that the world gets positive and unbiased news from the continent?
Well, African countries, they should be able to use soft power more effectively than they are. They don't always respond quickly and appropriately to false narratives. They let them go on for a long time. They're not, they are to some extent, they don't want to cause friction between themselves and some of the media. So they're afraid to say what I just said, is that the media is part of the problem, that the media is not objective. So they don't believe in fighting back as aggressively as they should, in an organized way, and in a rapid response manner. So stories circulate all around the world, negative stories about Africa, and they're not challenged. I would suggest that African countries form a unit of their government in the media, I would call it a rapid response team, and that they would respond to outright lies, negative comments, false information, false narratives, in a quicker way and more forceful way than they do.
Iran, just like African countries, has been on the receiving end of meddling and biased reporting by Western media. Recently, Iran's security agencies designated Iran International, the London-based Saudi-funded Persian-language TV network, as a terrorist organization responsible for instigating deadly riots in Iran. Iran's intelligence minister, Ismail Khatib, says this pseudo-media outlet has sought to foment insecurity and division in the country. Rioters and terrorists who wreaked havoc across Iran over the past months received their cue from Western media outlets.
You have the last word, Mr. Azikiwe. Now, Iran and many African countries are facing a similar challenge of being targets of meddling and incitement by mainstream Western media outlets. Now, how can they collaborate to counter these Western media onslaught?
Yes, the news agencies in Africa and in Iran and other countries should definitely collaborate because a lot of the news that is being put out over the Western networks are being filtered by the news agencies themselves, the commentators, those who do the analysis. It's not clear exactly what their political motivations are. Some of them clearly are not in favor of the Iranian government or other governments throughout the world. The BBC, for example, has a Persian service, yet they don't interview anyone from the Iranian embassy or the United Nations, from the many Iranian universities in regard to what's going on in Iran. It's the same situation that we have in regard to Ethiopia, Zimbabwe, and other countries in Africa. So it's a lot of bias that's going on that's passing for news.
Well, there you have it. Developing countries are all facing an onslaught by the mainstream Western media outlets, and therefore they need to collaborate to counter these negative coverage. I would like to thank our guests today, Mr. Bayomi Azikiwe and Lawrence Freeman, for their incisive analysis. And that brings us to the end of this week's edition of Africa Today. It's always great having you. Goodbye for now.
In the limelight.
Al Jazeera has said it has filed a lawsuit at the International Criminal Court against the Israeli regime forces over the killing of Palestinian journalist Shirin Abu Aghele, who was shot during an Israeli raid in West Bank in May. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites for further details.